It's history with a twist. You're listening to the Alternate History Show with Ben Kearns.
You certainly are. Welcome to Counting Them All, episode 9 of the Alternate History Show. Brilliant to be back with you. And over the course of the next 90 minutes, we're honing in on the Labour Party in the UK in the 80s and beyond. In particular, I'll be asking alternate historian Ewan Hodson, what if Sonny Jim Callaghan had won the election of 78 that never was, beating a certain Margaret Thatcher in the process? What if the Falklands War had never happened? How would Galtieri not invading have affected Labour politics? What about Dennis Healey as leader of the opposition in a footless 80s? Along with that, copious amounts of Brian Gould and John Smith and Peter Shaw. And an alternate history favourite in UK circles, Prime Minister Kinnock in 1992. That's all to come, plus in part three of this episode, a very special feedback hub, where I'm joined by Alex Wallace and friends to talk about the Allo-Americana anthology. Alex and all but two of the authors will be joining me to talk about it, as it was released just before Christmas. If you haven't got hold of it, I suggest that you do. But don't listen to me. Listen to them. In just over an hour, in part three of this episode. That's all to come. In my opinion, you won't want to miss any of it. Welcome to today's episode. As I was saying, all about Labour Party, the Labour Party in the UK in the 1980s, or as we're calling it, Raging Militant, Seething Social Democrats, and the Struggle for the Heart of Labour. And luckily, I've got someone to talk all about it. His name is Ewan Hodson. Hello.
Hello.
We like to get to know our guests before we get down to the crux of what we're meant to be talking about. So let's talk about how you got involved in alternate history. When did the fascination begin, really?
I think it was to do with steampunk I was younger, in my early teens. And then from there, you read all the like encyclopedias and books like that.
Yeah.
And they talk about alternate history as well. I kind of got into that. And then Alternate History Wiki, and then alternatehistory.com. And I didn't really do much for a while.
I think a lot of people have had that predicament. I was one of them, it has to be said. All right, well, let's talk about what we're meant to be talking about, of course. Let's start at the very beginning of the whole Labour Party struggle, the 1979 election, and just before it. In your opinion, how would Labour have managed during this time if, say, they were in government for some of it? Let's say that Callaghan calls that 1978 election that wasn't and wins. How would they have coped?
Callaghan will definitely retire in the early 80s, least nearly pushing 70 and everything like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you're definitely going to get like a soft left leader. So you have a lot of people like Peter Shaw and John Silkin, maybe Michael Foot. But the scenario to get Michael Foot in is very complicated.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because he did come top of the initial ballot, did he not, in 1976, when they were seeking someone to succeed Wilson.
Foot nearly got in. Roy Jenkins left at the last second to allow Callaghan to win as the right candidate. So you can already kind of see in the mid-70s this kind of shift towards the left trying to get power. That's probably going to happen in the early 80s. The problem is, the early 80s is a terrible time for any centre-left government. They will try to pursue deflationary policies depending on who's in charge. You read a lot of, like, the winter discontent was problems to do with corporations outside of the nationalised industries trying to give managers and bosses higher wages, and the workers went on strike. That's what happened at Ford. And then the nationalized work industries, the workers there were like, well, why don't we get wages?
Yeah.
So you're going to get stuff like that happening. Depending on who's Chancellor, you may get Shaw, who is not going to try and pursue deflationary policy.
And you could end up, of course, with a split ticket in this regard. You could end up with someone like Peter Shaw as Prime Minister, with Dennis Healey remaining as Chancellor, maybe, or vice versa, perhaps.
That is a wonderful recipe for chaos.
A fairly realistic recipe for chaos, though.
I actually pondered John Silkin becoming a soft left candidate, because he was discussed a few times as yes. being a soft left person.
Mm.
And the early 80s is his best chance. He would probably have Shaw as a chancellor. But what happens there is you're probably going to see attempts at deflationary policies, maybe even a loan from the IMF.
Mm.
And Shaw is not going to commit austerity policies.
No.
And so you get another recipe for chaos in the early 80s. Probably a centre-right conservative government afterwards.
Mm.
You definitely don't get a SDP split.
No.
In the same way.
Presumably Owen, for starters, would still be Foreign Secretary in this, or at least a big cabinet player of some description.
He was on the fence for a while.
Mm.
And then it was only when Foote came in, and then there was the changes to the Electoral College, and then after all that, the union supporting left-wing policies, he starts considering otherwise. He probably stays around.
Mm.
Maybe even Bill Rogers, because he accepted Secretary of Defense role in Foote's shadow cabinet, and Shirley Williams probably just stays in the private sector.
Yeah.
That's what she originally wanted to do, do academia. And it was only because of the SDP forming that she actually decided to join.
The likelihood is, with this scenario, you would end up with a tidy parliamentary majority, as that's what the polls were saying, either that or a hung parliament. And then you've got to wonder, I'm presuming the Lib-Lab pact would be sort of renewed to some degree under Callaghan until he retired. And then if someone like Shaw comes along, or dare I say at Foote, it's going to be blown out the water, really, isn't it? That's going to create even more chaos.
You may not even see the Lab-Lib pact return, because many of the Liberals were very offended with how Labour treated them. Even David Still was very on the fence about another confidence supplying deal. Maybe if Labour comes at them with a commitment to more electoral reform, maybe like a Scottish Assembly,
which they were sort of in favour of course at the time,
but that was also because the SNP won 10 seats.
Yeah.
And if Labour is doing well in 78, the SNP will probably see a wipeout down to what happened in 79.
Yes.
Maybe even slightly worse. In our world, they got 3.
Yeah.
So there is a very strong possibility that the call for assembly in Scotland maybe is diluted for a while. I don't think you're going to get a New Zealand or Australian situation in 80s Britain.
No.
Because of how those parties are. The Labour Party in New Zealand and Australia are very centrist for the most part. So adopting a Monetarist policy wasn't too outside of the remit for them.
I would agree with that. You probably need Heath governing Britain in the mid-70s and all that comes with that before anything like that could happen. Interesting. Well, let's move on to the post-1979 election. Post-1979. I mean, what if Callaghan had stood down sort of with immediate effect rather than waiting until the early 80s? What would have happened then?
There was a hope amongst the Labour right that he could shepherd a compromise candidate to be leader afterwards, which didn't happen because they went with Dennis Healey, which is the opposite of a compromise candidate. So if he had stood down, you maybe see kind of a very chaotic attempt to try and get the Labour right candidate, probably Dennis Healey, but you may see David Owen trying to make a punt. You're going to see a lot of attempts to try and find the unity candidate, which was what actually happened in 1980. Michael Foote presented himself as the unity candidate, so more middle of the road MPs were like, I'll take a punt with him. You probably get Peter Shaw as more major candidate. You're gonna have a hard time for the Labour right because as I said earlier, the Labour left is starting to make inroads. You probably may get Ben standing if it's a 1979 election. Because the reason why he didn't stand in 1980 was because he was persuaded by a number of his friends who said that he would invalidate any future leadership runs if he lost a PLP election. I think he may get caught up in the possibility of winning in 79. I may try and pursue a run. I probably fails.
So you get quite the crowded field then, basically, by the sound of things.
In the same way that 1980 was a bit of a crowded field, because everyone always remembers it as just being a Healy versus Foot leadership election.
Yeah.
But you have Peter Shaw and John Silkin, who also are big possible Labour candidates, but they didn't succeed because Foot was the left candidate.
Okay, well, let's turn to the actual 1980 election. And suppose that, anyone but Foot was elected leader. The obvious option, of course, being Dennis Healy. You sort of alluded to this a minute ago, really. Is there anyone else who could have run, who didn't, who might have been in the running to win if they had put their hat into the ring, so to speak?
So Peter Shaw was the left candidate for about a week before Stuart Holland, who was a friend of Ben and a Benite, wrote a letter to Michael Foot with a list of left-wing MPs he said would not support Shaw in a leadership contest.
Okay.
And that persuaded Foot to come in as the left candidate. It's easier to make Healy lose than it is to make Healy win, because he's such a bullish figure. The view that a lot of people have of him later being a bit jocular and kind of this person that appears on TV wasn't around in 1980. Most people remembered him for, as Brian Gould discusses, like prowling the Houses of Commons looking for people that vote against his bills and stuff and shouting them down. It's probably the best chance for Shaw. He was very much of the centre of the party. He was very pro-nuclear weapons, but very left-wing on economics. Small-C conservative on a number of issues. Very unionist, in both senses of the words, actually. Very trade unionist, and also very unionist on discussions like assemblies and stuff. Very anti-militant and Benite. He was part of the Labour Solidarity Campaign, which was kind of the early social democratic kind of wing of the Labour Party that didn't split off. Kind of the Labour right group. But Shaw was a bit detached from that because his policies and his economic ideals were very much left wing.
I did wonder as well why he wasn't, why the idea of him as a sort of compromise between Foot and Healy didn't really catch on in 1980.
Because he was at the centre of the Labour Party, he never really made a committed group around him. Dennis Healy at least has connections with Roy Hattersley and the Labour Union Barons, and Foot has the Tribune and the Bevanites and stuff.
Yeah.
Pete Shaw is a former Bevanite, but not that Bevanite anymore.
No.
Very divided on a lot of issues. And really the only real people that you could say are committed fans of Shaw are people like maybe Jack Straw, David Blunkett, Brian Gould, which says a lot about who were his followers.
You sort of floated the idea of Tony Benn running in 1980 and being persuaded not to. Had he put his hat into the ring, what would have happened? Would that have made, on its own, any material difference to the leadership election?
Well, he probably loses. And Foot is probably not the candidate. Which probably actually validates the Labour left candidate. Because Benn would have tried and then stumbled at the first hurdle. So he doesn't really manage to gain the same momentum that he did in real life. It would be interesting to have early 80s where Ben is kind of just a bit on the sidelines and, while still popular, is not able to be this figure of hope on the hard left and this ghoulish demon, I guess, on the right.
Yeah. I want to know, what if Dennis Healy had beaten Michael Foot then? What if it all come down to Foot versus Healy, and how could he have won? Is it as simple as saying, as not saying, you have nowhere else to go, and
Healy puts more effort into his campaign? As you said, he did his infamous, oh, you have nowhere else to go.
Yeah.
And then most of the SDP went, yes, we do. You'd have to more actively campaign.
Yeah.
You maybe need to see, I don't know, like a Bennett running.
Yeah.
Like some of the hard left. I don't know, Bob Cryer decides this is his pillar to die on or something. I think if Dennis Healy wins, you do definitely see a slightly different Labour Party. For example, the Falkland War, Foot supported it. And Shaw supported intervention in the Falklands. They were some of the biggest criers for it. With Healy, he was very much on the fence. He wanted UN kind of resolution to be drafted and, you know, all the Falklands return back to us, but maybe they eventually go to Argentina, like Hong Kong with China. And he's a bit more the mud and the blood. Look at the men that died here. Which would feel very weird with the pomp and the circumstance of like 82, 83. You maybe still get an STP split.
Yeah.
But it's not like the massive number of people that did in our world.
First of all, if he wins in 1980, it doesn't necessarily follow that he is still in place by 1982, because, of course, famously, Tony Benn challenged him for the deputy leadership in 1981. Does Benn instead challenge for the leadership in this scenario?
Oh, definitely. Benn may have a slight more chance of gaining the leadership, but he may not. It does depend on how vigorously Healy campaigns for his leadership position, and how many of the soft left decide to actually vote for him.
Yeah.
Because the thing that made it so narrow was that instead of voting for Benn or Healy, a number of people from the Tribune voted for John Silkin for the deputy leadership, and then they voted for abstaining. You maybe get Neil Kinnock throwing his lot in with the Labour right a bit earlier. He's still soft left Bevanite union boy at this point. But he maybe is campaigning for Healy because it's more of a crisis of confidence if Benn becomes leader.
I read an article which was quite amusing from a guy called Tim Healy, who is Dennis Healy's son. He's not, of course, a dispassionate observer on his father's work. He said, in response to lots of people saying, oh, Dennis Healy would be the best prime minister we never had, he in fact would be a terrible prime minister. And he didn't fall out with his dad. They were still very close. So it wasn't that. Is he being unfair on his father? Or is that true to a degree? And how would he be as leader of the opposition as well?
He would be a very chaotic leader of the opposition.
Yeah.
At least with Foot, he had proper journalistic training and media training. The problem was with Foot was that his media training was from the 60s.
Yeah.
So it wasn't as well in the 80s. So that was a lot of his problem. Healy does not have that. He's a character who kind of made a lot of his early starts in fighting CLPs and stuff and being, as I said, a very bullish and bullying figure. I think as Prime Minister and leader of opposition, he would try and do stuff like bully whoever's on the dispatch box, which I don't think would be the best look.
I wonder who would be Shadow Chancellor in this scenario, because, of course, it wouldn't be Healy, he'd be leader of the opposition. Would it be someone like Shaw or someone like that, or maybe even Foot himself?
I get the feeling Shaw, because Foot, I don't think, would want to be connected to economics. He wasn't really an economics person. Probably have a Home Secretary position or Foreign Secretary position.
Which would be interesting in itself, given his views on NATO and all that was going on at the time. Another scenario which a lot of people wonder is whether this just delays the hard left takeover of the Labour Party. If Healey loses in 1983, does Ben go for the leadership then? And does this sort of negate the comeback in 1987 to a degree and beyond?
The party was left-wing at the time, but they weren't hard left. So the best chance is probably for Neil Kinnock, amusingly, or maybe like Michael Meacher. I think Ben probably still loses in 1983. That's still a possibility. So it could just be we get the very boring scenario of Dennis Healey is replaced by everyone's favourite Welsh Bevanite.
Let's focus on 1981 and the SDP breakaway now. How could it have been averted or at least lessened to a degree?
I think if you get Peter Shaw or someone like John Silkin as the soft left leader, they may try and court the right more. You maybe get Roy Jenkins and the Jenkinites kind of just bumbling off to the Liberals. Will Rogers and Shirley Williams just heading into the private sector. Maybe David Owen stands an independent because David Owen
is David Owen.
There are ways to like have the SDP just stumble and fall the minute they kind of split. There was the possibility of George Brown trying to engineer his own Social Democratic Party.
Yeah.
As he kept on threatening throughout the 70s.
Yeah.
And if it's a George Brown Social Democratic Party, I think a lot of people are going to go, maybe not.
He might punch me apart from anything else.
George Brown has his habit of being tired and emotional.
Yeah.
And it's probably just going to be a Social Democratic Party that just consists of his brother and like two other people. And then Jenkins probably just defects the Liberals.
Yeah, yeah.
And then David Owen just kind of just awkwardly stays around and either resigns in 83 and, I don't know, becomes a BBC journalist or something. Seems like something you'd do.
Conversely, of course, how could the split have been worsened? The obvious way to do this, of course, would be to allow Tony Benn to become deputy leader in 1981. I think Mandelson, amongst others, said that if Benn had won, he would have joined the SDP.
I do think that is the best way. The way I like to think of it is it means the SDP does incredibly well in 1983.
Yeah.
And then they probably just kind of sink back down to a third party in 1987, or maybe they're just competing with Labour. Because I remember reading that David Steele tried to establish the SDP with Roy Jenkins' help as an attempt to, like, gain working class Labour voters. But then you remember what kind of people joined the SDP.
Yeah, yeah.
Very kind of Gary Hart, like suburban middle class.
Yes, yes.
People. If you're looking at the SDP becoming the premier centre-left party with the Liberals, you're probably looking at 20 years of Thatcherism and then, I don't know, Paddy Ashdown comes in like 1999 or something. It's very hard to have them become the main centre-left party.
I've heard as well that one way of enabling a greater split perhaps might be making Eric Heffer more prominent.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit more about Eric Heffer, please.
Eric Heffer is a very fascinating man. He was like one of the founders of Tribune.
Yeah.
But he was not what you'd call a Tribunite. He spent much of the 50s trying to unite the various Trotskyist and syndicalist little parties around to make a, like a left-wing unity party.
Yeah.
That, I think, says a lot about him. If you have a scenario where in 1981, Ben is struck down by Gillenbarry, which he did actually have in the summer, and it's weird that everyone just ignores that he got Gillenbarry in 1981 because it's a very debilitating disease. And so you could have a scenario where Ben is horribly ill. That probably delays deputy leadership contest. And you could maybe see Eric Heffer make a run. And he may do worse than Ben. But if he wins, Yeah. You suddenly have a man who is connected to militants and various hard left occupations as the deputy leadership. And you probably see, like, Roy Hattersley going,
maybe not.
Bye.
1983, then, and all that came after, the longest suicide note in history. Let's say that all goes according to, well, our world, really. Is there any way for anyone other than Kinnock to win?
You could have the scenario where Kinnock gets caught in his car crash. It's one of those ones where you read it and you go, wait, how bad was his car crash? And he came out with just a scratch.
Yeah.
Like, his car rolled over on the M26, I believe. Mm. And he came out just a scratch, which kind of made him even more messianic amongst the Labour left. Because you could compare it to Foote, who actually had a car crash in the early 60s, which was very horrible and left him with the limp that he had for all his life.
Yeah.
And then Neil Kinnock just comes out with just a scratch. And he's just like, oh, yeah.
Mm. He's all right, as he said all right. A few years later.
In that scenario, you maybe get Kinnock, who, in like hospital or something, saying for people to transfer their votes to his campaign manager, Robin Cook, who is most likely to be the Kinnock without Kinnock candidate. In a scenario where Kinnock doesn't run, you would probably try and get a Labourite compromise candidate, because Roy Hattersley is not going to win. Very few people liked him.
Dennis Healey did.
Dennis Healey liked him. Not even the Labour Solidarity campaign were all behind Roy Hattersley. I've always kind of thought that if you get Roy Hattersley to become Labour leader, you need to have a different late 70s. Callaghan, Healey, Roy Hattersley. But in 1983... he's not going to be the candidate who is a uniter of the soft left and right. Now, there are a few other people. I've always found Denzel Davis a very interesting possibility.
Okay.
He was anti-EC, pro-unilateral nuclear disarmament, but was very kind of Gaitskellite on a lot of economic policies and was connected to the kind of Labour centre. And he could be pushed as a possible compromise candidate. He didn't do very well in our world because 1983 was such a landslide for Kinnock and Hattersley as like the kind of ticket. Maybe Peter Shaw, they could convince him. Maybe Gwyneth Dunwoody, if you ignore Labour's problems with women in the period. I'll just quickly mention, the original idea for Michael Meacher wasn't to run as a deputy leadership candidate. He was to run for the leadership.
Okay, yeah.
And then Joe Richardson was going to run as the deputy leadership candidate for the, like, hard left.
Yeah.
And then Kinnock ran, and everyone on the hard left went, oh, well, we're not going to win. He probably would do better than Ben would.
Yeah.
I've always kind of taken that view because he's able to compromise.
Yeah.
Like, he became a member of Kinnock's shadow cabinet in time and part of the Blair cabinet. And he's a bit more articulate, a bit more media friendly. Like, you know, he appears in Edge of Darkness in a cameo, which is very random. But Kinnock has much of 83 sewn up. His last days in the 83 election were him doing his tour around the country. He was very media friendly. He does that speech where, you know, you don't grow old, don't be young, all that speech.
Yeah.
And that made him a media darling almost overnight.
Yeah.
And so much of the Labour Party is going, well, we're going to go with that guy.
How does a Denzel Davis or a Robin Cook leadership, or dare I say a Gwyneth Dunwoody leadership, how does that go down in the 80s?
Robin Cook probably follows a similar trajectory to Kinnock. Maybe a bit more committed to the soft left economic platform. You know, you probably don't get the kind of accusations of Robin Cook being a blowhard windbag that Kinnock got, because Kinnock was a very laddish, kind of almost populist figure in some ways,
yes,
which didn't jibe with what people wanted out of a Labour Prime Minister. And so much of the 80s is Kinnock trying to, like, deal with both sides of that. Cook is a bit more self-assured, probably does Kinnockism, but without Kinnock. Denzel Davis probably would be similar to a continuing Peter Shaw leadership. But if Peter Shaw had problems with alcohol, he had a habit of ringing up journalists and saying he was resigning. Yeah. And then the journalists that knew him would be like, oh, it's Denzel, we'll just wait until the morning. And then he'd call them and be like, I'm not resigning.
Yeah.
And then in 1988, he called a journalist who didn't know that. So he wrote a story saying Denzel Davis is resigning from the Shadow Cabinet. Mm. And Kinnock read it. It was like, okay,
bye then.
I accept your resignation. He is a very chaotic figure to have be Labour leader in the 80s. So he may not do very well.
A repeat of 1983, basically, which could be interesting.
Yeah, like 1983, but this time you can't blame the soft left for doing it. Mm. It's entirely fault of a guy who's connected to the Labour right.
This is the Alternate History Show with myself, Ben Kearns, and special guest Ewan Hodson, chewing the cud on the Labour Party in the UK in the 1980s. More on the way in part two of this episode. We'll be talking about Kinnock's relationship with the media in the 1980s after he became leader. In particular, what if he hadn't fallen in the sea? And what if Neil Kinnock had resigned after 1987. We'll be talking about everything between 1987 and that famous 1992 general election. That's all on the way. See you in part two.
This is the Alternate History Show. We revisit the past, change it, and see what happens. Enough said. Enough
said. Let's just say that Kinnock comes to the fore and is elected leader. How much would you say his accident in the sea, let's just say, would affect the next few years for him? I mean, a lot of people say, had he not done that, then he'd have been fine. And
that was part of a whole series of Kinnock being awkward with the media, because he was very used to them being very nice to him. And then he became Labour leader, and suddenly people making jokes about him. And it's very interesting because in 84, there's this weird attempt to make this media mastermind. It's very surreal. He's like appearing in a music video. He presents the Brit Awards. He appears on like the Tube. Kinnock, if he had played his card right, could have been a working class lad made good. I've kind of pondered before, if instead of Peter Mandelson being in charge of media management, it was Nita Clarke, because she lost by only 2 votes on the NEC. She was more populist. She was the person that led a lot of the GLC campaigns about unemployment and changing Ken Livingstone from what he was known in the early 80s as always supports the IRA and keeps on saying weird things about gay people, and changed him to like cuddly Ken with the Sun editorial.
Yeah.
And always likes newts, and he's a bit eccentric, but you can have him as the leader of a Labour council and he will do good things for you. You could see a similar thing with Neil Kinnock being this kind of working class lad made good figure.
Yeah.
He's a bit laddish, but you know, you'll get stuff done.
What's the best from 1983 onwards to 1987 that Kinnock can do, in your opinion? And what does he need to do in the intervening years to sort of get there?
Labour needs to have a better Greenwich by-election. That caused the whole rush about, oh, the SDP Liberal Alliance is going to be big again.
Mm.
If Labour wins that, or they lose the Tories, then what you get is a, you know, Tory versus Labour battle, which is what was originally meant to be. If things were slightly different, you could maybe see Labour gaining 40 seats instead of like 20. The 1987 campaign is fascinating to read about because it was very well done. And you also have problems with Roy Hattersley being Shadow Chancellor and then Neil Kinnock trying to show that he understands the policies that Hattersley is proposing.
Yes.
So you have those kind of problems of classic rivalry, Hattersley and Kinnock not getting along, so they have problems there. And you have the whole problems with Militant.
What would he need to do, and what would Labour need to do better to sort of more successfully purge Militant?
A better media campaign, the attempts to try and oust them from various places was often very incompetently done. You have a lot of very bungled investigations. There's a great bit in the book about the Kinnock leadership, where it talks about attempts to get rid of different Trotskyist organization called the Socialist Organizer, who had managed to get a candidate called Lawrence Duffy to be the candidate for Linda Chalker's seat, and he nearly won. It was just a 200 vote difference between the two. You have like very bungled reports filled with spelling mistakes and like grammatical errors, which I don't think a different leadership would change if there was more attempts to try and reach out to some members of the hard left a bit more, then maybe things could have been easier. But the problem with Militant was, in places where Militant was popular or very well bedded, they had the support of local left-wing trade unions who weren't Trotskyist, but they were like, well, they're good socialists. We'll work with them. So I think to oust Militant, you need better legal processes, a Labour Party that is not stuck in the 70s in terms of structure.
And conversely, how could the fight against Militant have gone worse for those who were fighting it?
They tried to target Militant members, but if they had been like, Eric Heffer is connected to Militant, we'll get rid of him, you definitely do get a situation where there is more of a battle with the hard left. And maybe then that would cause Militant to reach out to a lot of the kind of the liberation organizations. One of the problems with Militant was it was very white and very heteronormative and very male in its outlook, very old left. And they had problems with trying to reach out to the kind of new left organizations. And so they only started doing it towards the end. So you kind of see in the 1990s, this attempt to reach out to them, you know, they start talking about gay rights parades and black liberation and stuff like that. So you could maybe see them, if they get attacked earlier and more viciously, they could maybe try and reach out to like the black socialist societies and kind of elements connected to gay rights and stuff.
Pushing on now to 1987 and what went after. Why didn't Kinnock resign, first of all, as Foot had, and what would have happened if he had?
He saw it as they'd won the campaign. One more heave. But there was actually discussions after everything cooled off and you go into 88 where Kinnock starts suffering from depression for much of 1988 before the leadership election and his victory then. Against Ben, which kind of reinvigorated him.
Yes.
There were discussions amongst people outside of Kinnock about what would happen if he resigned. And so it's very possible that he doesn't immediately resign, but in 88, he just resigns. The best possibility for that is John Prescott wins the 1988 deputy leadership contest. And that was a lot to do with a lot of the soft left felt that Kinnock was being too friendly with the Labour right. In our world, Kinnock was able to essentially use his own personality to convince unions and CLPs that if they voted for John Prescott, he would resign.
Yeah.
And they essentially went with, okay, we're not voting for Roy Hattersley here, we're voting for Neil Kinnock. So if he doesn't manage to do that, then that's a wound against him. So he resigns. Okay. And then that leads to a very weird 88, 89, where you get a kind of almost a precursor to the Our World 1992 leadership election. Because the candidates in question that are going to be most popular are John Smith and Brian Gould. But it's more of an equal battle because Brian Gould was seen as having won the 87 campaign. And he's a bit of a media darling himself.
It's interesting as well because 1988 and another medical reason, of course, why Gould might be at an advantage is this is around about the time when John Smith had his heart attack. Which, on balance, who do you think wins?
I kind of always go usually with Brian Gould wins because okay. he had much of the soft left sewn up. And if John Smith suffers his heart attack and is out of commission for much of the election, then he probably loses. So you get a kind of Keynesian, Eurosceptic socialist as Labour leader, as the Labour Party is becoming more of a kind of a supply-side socialism, Europhile party. Social Democratic Party.
Yeah.
I've kind of slowly come around to the view that Brian Gould would have been an okay leader.
Yeah.
Very media friendly. He knew what was the best policies probably to pitch the media. But his problems are he's very specific on policy. He has his eccentricities. And he had his own health scare in 1987. I think it was lymphoma. But he managed to recover from that and no one found out. But if he were to become a Labour leader, there's a very strong chance that that comes out and then there's a lot more questions about, oh, what about the health of our leader?
Yeah.
And so that leads to probably very awkward moments.
Does a Gould late 80s, early 90s, in your view, fare better or worse than a Kinnock 1980s, early 90s, assuming that things on the Tory side fall as they did in our world?
There is just as much possibility of things being better, just as much as it could be a bit worse. I think if Thatcher resigns like she did, and Gould is against John Major or Michael Heseltine, then their message of, look at this Labour Party that hasn't changed at all, they're going to come and increase your taxes and, you know, increase your mortgages and stuff. So that would probably win through. Even if Gould was campaigning on, we're going to lower taxes and we're going to do this and we're going to do that. Like, if Bill Clinton was left-wing in kind of energy.
And in the UK.
But he could do better, particularly if it's against Thatcher. Because he can rail on about her economic inadequacies, her inadequacies as leader. He probably does better on the dispatch box. And he's probably more media-friendly at that point. So if it was a Thatcher versus Gould contest, you could probably get a small Labour majority in the early 90s.
Interesting. And if it's Gould versus Major, it's probably around about the same of what we had.
Maybe a bit better for Labour.
Okay.
So you maybe get Major having to shack up with the Ulster Unionists.
Yes.
But I don't think it's going to be a decisive Labour majority.
Okay.
Maybe a Labour-Lib Dem coalition, which would be fascinating to see because you have Brian Gould, the Eurosceptic, with Paddy Ashdown.
Yeah. who is not Eurosceptic.
Yeah.
Okay. And what if we imagine a Smith leadership in that time? How does Smith do as leader against, well, Thatcher, Major and the like?
Smith probably does okay. He probably has a lot of problem with the Labour Party, particularly the soft left. You'd have to act more conciliatory to them. So you may get a weird scenario where, like, Robin Cook or Brian Gould gets offered the chancellorship because he has to keep them in-house.
Yes.
Which he tried to do in our world when he became leader. A lot of what Smith did in the 90s was kind of attempts to, like, divert from his personality beforehand, where he wasn't very friendly to the soft left. As leader, you probably get very kind of old-fashioned social democratic leadership. He definitely has problems with feminists in the party due to his views on abortion. There's a biography of John Smith which proposes that if he had won in 89, he probably would have seen an attempt against him by a female soft left candidate in 89-90. So you could maybe see attempts by him to, like, fill his cabinet win. You may see an earlier promotion of Margaret Beckett and Joe Richardson, because they probably still would kind of diverge from the Socialist Campaign Group because of just how the then 88 campaign was just run, which was just very badly done.
Yes.
There was an interesting proposal where if Kinnock had just resigned before Ben did his leadership challenge, some members of the Socialist Campaign Group were proposing that they nominate Dennis Healey as their leadership candidate against John Smith and Brian Gould on a kind of platform of, oh, we don't like this guy, but we know what he's going to do. They had to be dissuaded from it because they were like, you know, Dennis Healey is going to be 72 around 1992. Yeah. So why would you have him as as a Labour leader?
Little did they know that Joe Biden would come along 30 years later in the US, and of course Churchill a few years beforehand, and Gladstone and the like. Well, let's focus a little bit more on that leadership challenge by Tony Benn then. What was so bad about it in your view, and why did it not amount to much, and what could it have amounted to, assuming Ben can't beat Kinnock for the Labour leadership in 1988, which I'm guessing he can't.
No. No. Kinnock was very popular with still the left of the party. They liked him. They thought he was a good guy. But they didn't like that he was being too friendly with people like John Smith and Roy Hattersley, which maybe could have been diluted if Brian Gould was Chancellor, which he was offered originally, and then Roy Hattersley used his power to say no and got John Smith as the candidate.
Yeah.
Which you probably see Brian Gould become Chancellor if John Smith dies in 1988.
Okay. Okay.
Which maybe Gordon Brown.
Okay.
Oh, wait, I'm getting off topic.
But, yeah, we will come on to that. That's going to be next on the list of topics. So that's all good.
Yeah, I think the problem with Ben in 88 is he's kind of almost a distraction. He had lost his chance in many ways. And he was getting older at this point. You're more likely to have an 88 where John Prescott wins deputy leadership, which is interesting because then Kinnock probably resigns. Yeah. But if he would stay, you get two working class lads. May good.
Let's move on then to that 1988 and John Smith. I want to focus on what if he hadn't had a heart attack at all, actually, first of all, because of course that propelled Gordon Brown to acting shadow chancellor for a while. How does that affect things?
So you maybe get a very mild thing with like Nigel Lawson probably retiring a bit earlier because John Smith is able to continue his attacks on him. You still get the thing of Gordon Brown would be being groomed as Smith's successor. That was kind of thing. They had a very close relationship from the start. And so if he doesn't have a heart attack, then you kind of get this thing where Smith is the happy-go-lucky chancellor. Gordon Brown is his right-hand man. Gould keeps on making noises every so often, but probably gets kicked out the shadow cabinet in time due to being too left-wing. But I think the heart attack probably means that he doesn't exercise as much and doesn't go on a diet. There's a lot of stuff in his biography about how he became a massive bore about calories. I think the other thing is, Smith was talked about a lot as a potential leader, but they didn't stick the landing because his heart attack kind of made a lot of people more anxious about maybe supporting a Smith leadership coup. Those rumours and the whisperings around that probably become more prominent, which may make Kinnock more paranoid.
What if he had, of course, died, succumbed to his heart attack in 1988? Some people say it's Gordon Brown who gets the shadow chancellor job. Some people say it's Brian Gould. You said earlier on, in your opinion, it is Gould. How does that work out?
In 88, Brian Gould is still very good friends with Kinnock. He was the original candidate anyway. And Smith's heart attack coincides with Kinnock winning the 88 leadership election, which kind of took any power out of Roy Hattersley. So Kinnock is probably like, I want my man to be chancellor, which makes Gould probably a bit more bulletproof. Because in 89, the media turned against him. There was a lot of stuff about how he was two-faced in his political views on water nationalisation. The policy for Labour was, we're not going to renationalise water and Gould said he supported nationalising water. And so this led to a whole media fracas, which led to Gould's minor downfall. So he got demoted, essentially. So if you see Gould as Chancellor, he probably doesn't get that. And he probably gets a bit more free rein to pursue his own policies that he talked about in a lot of his books and stuff. Maybe filtered through it, supply side, socialist lens. I don't think he's going to be able to be like, oh, we're committing to Keynesianism in like 1989. But he'd probably be able to talk a lot about cooperative businesses, employment, share ownership programs, which were kind of a very brief fluttering amongst the left in the late 80s as a potential for kind of worker-managed businesses.
Yes.
Where employees own their own shares and then they use those shares to buy the companies.
How does Gordon Brown do as a shadow chancellor, assuming he gets the role in the post-Smith environment?
Brown probably pursues a lot of the policies that Smith did. So he's less frightening to business.
Yeah.
He does probably still does the prawn cocktail campaign, but more successfully. And probably uses a lot of his energy to shotgun any soft left people against him, which he did under John Smith's tenure. So he probably does his attempts to like take over Tribune and the various policy review
platforms,
organizations.
Yeah.
But if he is Chancellor in 91-92, a bit like Gould, he probably makes Labour campaign on a manifesto of reducing taxes for the middle classes, more business friendly. You know, you're still going to get policies like the investment bank because the policy review supported that. And you're probably still going to keep a nationalised railway system and probably devolved economic powers to like an assembly and stuff and councils.
Shifting on now to sort of 1990-1991 time. And if we imagine that Thatcher somehow remains in power post 1990, when's the next election held and what is the result for Labour?
If Thatcher stays on in 1990, you probably see her attempting to try and call a snap election. She has a habit of doing that. Probably after the Gulf War, because there was a brief polling bounce for the Tories, but that probably very quickly shifts back down just because of economic problems.
Power,
she's not very well in 91. She probably spends a lot of time talking about like Hayek and complaining about the EEC as much as fighting Labour and fighting a very 1983-1987 campaign in the early 90s, which isn't very good for the Conservatives, because by that point Labour is less scary.
Sure.
They aren't seen as this boogeyman of the hard left anymore, because they aren't there anymore in any particular sense.
Numbers, yeah.
So you kind of get this scenario where Thatcher probably loses, probably actually very hard. You probably get a very slim Labour majority. I don't think Labour's going to be getting like a landslide, but you could see Labour gaining a majority of 10, 15, or maybe like a Harold Wilson style majority of 5. But the thing about Labour at the time is, even if they do get a very slim majority, the Lib Dems are most likely going to support a lot of their policies.
Yes.
Their manifestos align a lot in 1991, 1992.
Yeah.
So they're probably going to support a slim Labour majority, and they probably don't want Thatcher back.
What about against Heseltine? What if Heser had won in 1990? I don't quite know how that would happen, because he who wields the knife and all that lot, but let's just say it happens, say someone else had challenged Thatcher and Heseltine had sort of emerged afterwards.
Or you have Kenneth Baker.
Yeah.
Runs. He's often kind of used as the, oh, if Major gets found out about his affair with Curry, he probably becomes Chancellor, or the kind of bland Thatcher,
non-offensive
Thatcherism candidate. With Heseltine, you maybe see a very slim Labour majority. Like, we're talking like 64 Harold Wilson levels. That's very possible. It's just as possible that Labour is forced into a coalition with the Lib Dems. I think Heseltine at best is maybe going to get a confidence and supply deal with the Ulster Unionists.
Yeah.
I think the reason why John Major managed to do so well was because Labour shot itself in the foot with taxes, but also the Tory campaign was really good. It appealed to the middle classes, upper classes, and working class, because you have a campaign where it goes, look, we made this working class lad Prime Minister. His policies mean that you can own your own houses and your mortgages will be reduced and stuff. And at the time, people didn't know about Black Monday and everything, and how committed John Major was to joining the ERM.
Yeah.
Which I think is something I may quickly mention.
Yes.
With Kinnock.
Yeah.
Because that's often used as a thing of, oh, if Kinnock won in 91, 92, then
Black Wednesday would have...
Yeah, we get Black Wednesday.
Yeah.
But Kinnock was mildly apprehensive about the ERM. It could make things better for Labour and Britain going into the 90s. Because you don't have this sudden money trading away from the pound. Italy managed to devalue and wasn't immediately kicked out. If Labour manages to stay into the ERM, the Bundesbank is probably happy to let them do that. Because in our world, they were very ambivalent about John Major pursuing the policies they did. They were like, oh, there's a lot of possibility for success for you to become a German-style social market state.
Yeah.
But there's just as much possibility that you crash and burn, which happened. So Germany would probably be okay with Gordon Brown or Neil Kinnock pursuing a devalued pound inside the ERM. The question in the room is if John Smith does that.
Yeah, does John Smith do that?
Very anti-devaluation. Even Brian Gould was very pro-devaluation. So if you have John Smith, there's a very strong possibility that if you see a Black Wednesday scenario starting to appear, you could maybe have him being forced out. And then he gets replaced very quickly by Gordon Brown, who does what needs to be done to stop the economy from imploding.
Shifting on then to the 92 election, let's say everything until 1992 and the campaign goes more or less as it did in our world, how could Labour have pulled off some sort of victory, or how well could they have done?
So I think if John Smith doesn't say that he's going to raise taxes, but even if Labour says we're going to raise taxes, but here's a bunch of social programmes that we're going to be using these taxes to fund.
Yes.
Which was one of the main problems, was that Labour was going, we're going to raise taxes.
We're not going to tell you what for. Yeah.
You have Peter Sissons like questioning John Smith. It's like, why are there no reason for these taxes being raised? And John Smith was like, look, this is just how things are going.
Yeah.
That wasn't very popular. If Labour pursues a slightly less presidential campaign, if it's a bit more like the 87 campaign, smaller team, because the problem with 92 was they had a person called John Underwood, I believe, who was to be the new communications director.
Yeah.
And then he pursued a policy of, I want every member of the NEC and the Shadow Cabinet to be shown, not just Kinnock. And then Kinnock got angry and replaced him with Peter Mandelson. And he resigned about 6 months before the election happened. So they didn't have a media communications director, which, if you know anything about politics, having a not having a media communications director is not very good.
No, sounds like a good idea, but it doesn't work.
Yeah. And so you have this very bloated campaign in 92, too many adverts that also run off topic.
Yeah.
Very controversial adverts as well. You had the Jenny's Ear saga. There was a poster about a young girl that died because she didn't get surgery from the NHS, and that was also very controversial.
Mm.
There was a lot of campaigning on the NHS, which could have succeeded if they hadn't made that their main crux and hadn't made it also a presidential campaign where it's like, do you want Neil Kinnock or John Major to be your prime minister?
Yeah.
And most people went, I like John Major.
Yeah. Sounds like a nice guy, and we've got him at the moment, so let's stick with the devil that you know, basically.
Yes, that's kind of what happened. Mm. And the media people surrounding Kinnock tried to make him look more like Thatcher and act more like Thatcher after Thatcher had been ousted.
Yeah.
So it's like a very poorly kind of planned campaign. A campaign that revolved a lot around a man who still wasn't that popular.
Mm.
The Labour Party was doing okay.
Yeah.
And Kinnock was doing okay.
Mm.
But that wasn't great. There is a possibility of 1992 leading to Labour maybe gaining the plurality of seats. And in that situation, you're probably going to see a Labour-Lib Dem coalition.
With presumably Kinnock as Prime Minister, Paddy Ashdown as in the deputy job. That could be interesting as well.
Kinnock and Ashdown didn't really like each other.
Yeah.
On a personal basis.
Yeah.
But I could see the parties working fairly well together.
Mm.
You'd probably see a call for electoral reform and maybe have something a bit like New Zealand, where you had the referendum that they had in the early 90s, which is probably one of the best chances to get people to vote for an alternative voting system. Mm. After so many years of Thatcher and slim Labour majorities, if you're a centre-left voter, you may be a bit more convinced to vote for a change in how Britain votes its leaders.
Mm.
You definitely see the creation of a Scottish Assembly.
Yep.
Wales is
up in the
different
air.
Yeah. Kinnock supported it, and the Welsh Secretary, Ron Davis, supported it. But just because they support it doesn't mean that it's going to win. It was such a slim majority for a Welsh Assembly.
Yeah.
In our world, that it's very possible that
it doesn't happen.
I think one would appear eventually. You maybe see like a weird London Assembly being formed, and then maybe something like the North East and Yorkshire. That was attempted under Blair, but the enthusiasm wasn't there. Whilst with Kinnock and Paddy Ashdown being in charge, you probably see a big push for these assemblies in the same way that there wasn't under Blair.
You've been listening to part two of this episode of the Alternate History Show. My name is Ben Kearns, and I'm joined for another few minutes by Ewan Hudson. In those few minutes, we are going to quickly touch on how Kinnock becoming Prime Minister in 1992 would affect the Conservatives. We'll hear more about that. And also, could anyone other than John Smith have become Labour leader in 1992? We'll be asking those questions, and then we've got a very special feedback hub for you. I'm going to be joined by Alex Wallace and a whole host of guests to discuss the Allo Americana anthology. That's all to come if you listen to part three of this episode of the Alternate History Show.
It's history with a twist. You're listening to the Alternate History Show with Ben Kearns.
And on the other side of the aisle, what do you get? I'm guessing that Major might even still be a player in this scenario because he's still quite young. If he loses in 1992, does he perhaps stay on as leader of the opposition, or does someone else come in to fight Kinnock in the next election? And how does that pan out?
I feel like there would probably be an election not very long afterwards.
Okay.
So if it's 1992 Lab Lib Dem coalition, you probably see an attempt at electoral reform.
Yep.
The kind of various things that I talked about. And then probably in roundabout 94-95 snap election, so Labour can gain a majority if electoral reform hasn't happened. Major would probably still be a player in that scenario, but if not, it's very hard to think who would be the new Conservative leader in a Major resigns in like 92-93. Jonathan Aitken tries to pursue as the Tory right candidate.
That would be interesting.
Yeah, he probably would fail horribly or be arrested for corruption. Michael Howard is probably the best Tory right candidate for that time.
Yeah.
Michael Portillo is still too young and hasn't made a name for himself as much yet. The main person that probably you'd want to succeed Major is probably Chris Patten.
Yeah.
And he loses a seat. Maybe Ken Clark, but he's a bit too Europhile. And you may see the dramatic return of Michael Heseltine.
Yeah.
But even then, if that happens, I doubt he would win. You maybe get Norman Lamont, possibly.
Okay.
But if Norman Lamont is the Tory leader in like the mid-90s, he's probably going to lose because he's not very charismatic or very personable.
At least he can cling to the comparison with Desert Orchid, I suppose.
Major's probably the most likely to actually last.
Wow. Okay.
Just because the field against him is just so divisive.
You sort of alluded to this earlier on, but I'm guessing Brian Gould would be the alternative to John Smith post-92. How could we get him to win? And, I mean, there were other people that were being talked about. Even Brown had been suggested. Who else could have done it?
The problem with John Smith in 92 is he is the uniting candidate. Ben supported him, Diane Abbott supported him, and then you have Tony Blair supports him.
Mm.
What a coalition.
I know.
Brian Gould was seen as very retrograde.
Yeah.
And most of his supporters were people that liked Brian Gould in 89.
Yeah.
So you have David Blunker as his campaign manager. I actually asked David Hanson on Instagram, and it turns out that Brian Gould just didn't bother trying to talk to any of the 1992 MPs at all.
Oh.
It was just like, oh, vote for me. And then would leave a room and they'll be like, why would we vote for this person? Who is he? Whilst John Smith very actively courted a lot of the 1992 MPs, which was why it was such a decisive
victory for him.
I think for alternative candidates, you're looking at the deputy leadership. I think if Anne Clwyd had managed to gain the support and Brian Gould decided to step aside, which I don't think he would, she could pursue a line of she's the continuity kiddick down to the accent.
Yeah.
But a woman. And she probably does better than Gould just because of Smith's problems with women, which is why you probably see Margaret Beckett win in 1992. Because she was soft left, but not too left. You know, started the socialist campaign group connections.
Mm.
She was feminist, which is why you probably see her very narrowly beat John Prescott. I think a number of MPs and CLPs and stuff were like, well, I like John Smith, but there's all that stuff that he believes. That's not really what I believe.
Yeah.
I think I will vote for a woman deputy leadership because abortion was still a very controversial topic within the Labour Party, just because there were still a number of Labour MPs who supported reducing the amount of time that you could wait for abortion. If Anne Clwyd was convinced to run, she maybe could do fairly decently. Ken Livingstone talked, which it's Ken Livingstone.
But, yeah, make of it what you will.
Yeah, but he said that he wanted to pursue a leadership campaign and he couldn't.
Mm.
And he talked about how Anne Clwyd also wanted to pursue one but couldn't because there wasn't enough MPs because of how they changed the rules after 88. So Brian Gould was kind of the best candidate because he was the only one able to gain the very small amount of support to actually pursue a leadership contest.
Mm.
If he had stepped aside and maybe proposed another person, things could have maybe gone better, but it's very sewn up for John Smith. And I think even if Gordon Brown competed, which he won't, because they're friends,
yeah,
he's going to lose to Smith, which I think was kind of why Mandelson and Blair tried to persuade him to do it.
Yeah.
Because then they could be like, oh, Gordon Brown has lost to John Smith, and then I can come in as the beautiful leader that you've always wanted.
Yeah. Ewan, it's been brilliant chatting to you.
It's been lovely getting to rabble.
Yes, hopefully we can get you back to rabble more in the future.
I hope so.
About another topic. So we'll look forward to that. Ewan Hodgson, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
This is the Alternate History Show. We revisit the past, change it, and see what happens. Enough said. Enough said.
And welcome to a very special Feedback Hub for today, where we're looking at Allo Americana, a project put together lovingly by, well, amongst others, our very own Alex Wallace, and he is now here. Hello.
Hello.
Tell us a little bit more about how you put together the project. How did it happen? How did it start? How did you get to the finished product, basically?
What happened is that Tom Black at Sea Lion Press put out a call for anthology ideas.
Mm.
And so I saw that David Flynn had an alternate history British mythology collection. So, like, why can't we have one? So I just throw it in there. He's like, let's see what happens. And then Tom Black gets back to me and is like, okay. And I'm like, okay. And so then I put out the word. And then over the next year and a quarter, I just nag people until we have an anthology. Yeah, now I'm a published author, and so are many people here.
And it has been discussed on this show. I think we did touch on it once during the Feedback Hub, and at that point you were in the sort of middle stages, and now here we are. You've got quite the crowd helping you out on the anthology as well, and some of them join us today. Charlton Cousins, no stranger to the Alternate History Show, is with us. In fact, I'll let all you guys introduce yourselves and say a little bit about how you got into alternate history in the first place.
Hi everyone, my name is Charlton Cousins. I got into alternate history more than 10 years ago. My focus nowadays is mostly on alternate histories involving America and Britain, but my original start was on a project called 1983 Doomsday. I had to convince someone that post-apocalyptic Michigan could not have more helicopters than the pre-World War III RAF, which was an amusing conversation to have with someone.
I remember you telling us about that when you were on talking about Rhodesia and Zimbabwe, of course, on our podcast back in May last
year. Yes, recently I finished an alternate history timeline about a South Africa which becomes a full democracy in the 1960s, avoiding apartheid.
Josiah, what about you?
I got into alternate history really from Mark Twain's Connecticut Yankee and King Arthur's Court. I think I read it about the age of 10, 11. I've always created stories based on things I like. That kind of sparked. And then I have no memory of how I found it. I guess I was looking for stuff like that. I just stumbled across alternatehistory.com back in its kind of heyday. Got just sucked into it. That's actually how I met Alex Wallace. The Brits always seem to be able to meet up for stuff. So we tried to get some American stuff going. And of course, it's like herding cats. Me and Alex became friends out of that attempt. Mm. So a love for history, and then just the intrigue of what if things had gone differently? And that's the question I think that intrigues all of us.
Matthew, what about you?
My introduction to it, I suspect, actually came through Sliders, the 1990s TV series, at least in terms of alternate history as a concept. But I didn't get around to reading anything kind of until my sort of teens in high school. Mm. And I came across, I think it was there's an anthology called this, like, the greatest alternate history stories of the 20th century or something in my local public library. I ended up reading, and that was kind of like, wow, this is a thing that exists. And I grew up in North Alabama, which was home to NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center and the U.S. Space and Rocket Center, which is the only place in the world with two Saturn V rockets from the Apollo program. So I had been aware of all this space stuff from the 60s that had been planned but never carried out. And sort of alternate history was kind of a good excuse to go and explore all that in a kind of funny sort of way. One of the interesting accidents of that was I inadvertently won the Sidewise Award in the process for a story I actually had published in Alternate Australias, which is another anthology from Sea Lion Press.
Yes.
And it was actually on that forum that I met Alex and just happened to see us call and said, what exactly is your definition of urban legends, which I think was what you had originally called for. And I ended up going from there, really, and getting into the anthology and then eventually having a novel and other stuff published by Sea Lion as well.
Excellent. It's nice to meet someone who inadvertently won an award for the first time. I don't think I've met anyone who's done that before. So met people who have inadvertently won, purposefully.
Yeah, but it is very surreal having that thing, because I never in a thousand years would have thought that would have been the short story to win.
Fabrice, same questions to everyone as to yourself.
Alternate history has been with me my entire life, but I didn't have the words or sort of framework to understand it and necessarily place myself in the long body of work of that genre. So I grew up in Port-au-Prince, Haiti. It's like a metropolis city on the bay of like the Caribbean. And I think a lot of the history as the first independent Black nation, when I first moved to the US when I was 13, I think a lot of my thinking was really trying to understand my history, like the coup d'etats, the Duvalier era, the dictatorship. There's such a rich history to Haiti. And when I moved here, I think a lot of my thinking was like, how can I affect change in the world? How can I really just bring sort of narrative change? And I saw like science fiction and fantasy is such a fascinating process to really embolden our imagination. So like I run a production house of like global writers. And what we do, we create fictional universes together. And they use those fictional universes to write and create. And it's such sort of a way to reimagine this sort of individualistic. So I met Alex. I was a member of the Washington Science Fiction Association, and we became friends there. And I heard about the process, and I'm always had the task of writing and creating. For me, a lot of my fascination is the world building aspect, is like, what are those minor elements that changes in the world, and how does the entire way of thinking, way of being really changes? So I think I'm dedicating myself now. I'm based in LA, and I think a lot of alternate history is rich. It really makes you think very deeply.
Sam, you've talked about your interest in alternate history. How did it all start?
If you'll excuse me for a minute, I kind of got to coordinate some animals. I'm sorry if that interfered with all this.
Are you in a Disney movie, Sam? Because you might be in a Disney movie.
Crisis averted. Okay. I honestly can't really remember when specifically I got into alternate history, but if I had to guess, I remember that I used to be like really fascinated with space colonization, and I would read all the Wikipedia articles about it. So I was reading one that was about, you know, fiction that dealt with the colonization of Mars, and it had a section talking about, you know, what if Mars had been a habitable world like people used to think it was, and it mentioned a novel called A World of Difference by a dude named Harry Turtledove, and I think, what's this? So I click on it. It looks interesting. I
and
read
that
about
will not be the last time you've heard of him.
Yeah, I read about all of his other books, and that's how I fell down the rabbit hole of alternate history. But even without that, I'd always kind of been wondering about how history might have gone differently. Like, say, what if the American Revolution failed? What if the South won the Civil War? You know, stuff like that. So I guess it was just kind of natural that I came that way.
Alex, tell us a little bit more about the theme of the anthology, because it's Myths of Alternate Americas. Tell us a little bit more about how you came up with the concept.
I think the reason that the theme appealed to me is that we assume on some level any given country has its traditional stories, and that on some level we assume that these things are set in stone, that they're timeless, that they go back forever, when the reality is they're not. They're historically contingent. A nation's folklore is its history, and in one way or another. And I figure that given how recent, relatively speaking, the United States is as a country, I figure like there'd be a lot to play around with that theme. That's what I set out to do, and given the stories I got, I think I succeeded. Although, really, I didn't build that. Everyone else did.
You did your bit, of course, because you did your own sort of story within. Tell us about that. Tell us about the story that you did.
I actually wrote it for a vignette competition on the Sea Lion Press Forum. Within a few days of getting the go-ahead for the anthology, and the theme was all ages, write an alternate history story for children. And so what I did was rewrite the story of George Washington, the cherry tree, in a world where the British win the American Revolution, 13 colonies remain under the British crown. And so what I did with that is radically reinterpret the message of that story, because the traditional way that Americans tell that story is that it's about honesty. Like, I can never tell a lie, what would you say our first president said as a young man. And so juxtaposing this in a world where Washington remains with the British, it becomes a story about not abusing your power, not abusing your responsibility. And so just in a different world, the story means something very different. So that's what I was playing with in my story.
Moving on now to you, Fabrice. What's your story all about?
The title of it is called Dawn of the Sun. And I think a lot of my work as a science fiction and fantasy writer deals with like Afrofuturism or race and colonization, sort of the legacies of this decaying world that has created so much harm in people. And it tells the story of Akiwasa, which is my attempt to reimagine what would it look like if like the native tribal nations gathered together around this supernatural young woman, and how her legacy is really to unite her people. I think a lot of it was also thinking through, like, how could that even be possible? Like, would the European powers need to support this sort of uprising or this melding of the nation? So I think it was a fascinating way to just sort of expand on the possibility and show people what could be if this had changed.
Moving on now, I think, Matthew, you're going to tell us now about your story.
Mine's called A Time for Treason, and the part of the reason I had asked Alex about the definition of urban legends is that, you know, there's a lot of real-life events which have now become so mythologized. They've entered part of the lexicon and the culture in that respect. And D.B. Cooper, the famous 1971 hijacking, this guy who gets all this money and jumps out of the back of an airplane with some parachutes and is never seen again, is one of those things that sort of entered the sort of the pop culture lore. Ironically, in between the time I wrote it and when it came out, of course, we had the first episode of Disney Plus's Loki, where we found out that Loki was really D.B. Cooper, just to kind of give an idea of how much it entered the culture. But also trying to figure out a twist on it and thinking about what else was going on in the world at that time. And of course, you have Nixon in the White House gradually becoming more and more paranoid. You've got the Vietnam War going on. Arguably, if you push things a little bit further in the early 70s, you could end up in a very dystopic situation. I ended up putting a version of D.B. Cooper on Nixon's Air Force One and letting it play out from there. Figuring out my way into that ended up being the hard part, because it was like, I have the idea, but how do I get him onto the plane? And it was actually talking about it with one of my bosses at work at my day job that actually got me into it, which, for anybody who does read the story, there's two Secret Service agents at the end of the story that are named after him. So I used his first name and his last name as a way of saying thank you to him. That's basically the premise of mine, was, you know, D.B. Cooper in a slightly dystopic 1970s.
Which were already moderately dystopic anyway, so there you have it. Okay. Sam and the Animals. That should be a name for a band, I think. But anyway, completely different subject. Sam, tell us about your story.
This wasn't actually the first folk tale type story I'd written. Previously, I had worked with this website called The Moonlit Road. They adapt ghost stories, folk tales, and urban legends from across the American South, and they've got a podcast that will sometime produce their stories and audio. Oh, so I'd wanted to work with them for a while. I had written a story that was an adaptation of the Japanese folktale Urashima Taro, but set in 19th century Louisiana, and another one that was an adaptation of the Golem of Prague, set in South Carolina. The way I approached this anthology was basically, okay, so it's an alternate world. What sort of stories would I be trying to retell in that sort of place? And I've always been fascinated by the concept of America getting colonized by, you know, not just the set of nations that did in our timeline, especially nations that are from Europe. I mean, not the most realistic, but it's interesting to think about. There's some good story to be had there. And, you know, Shinto, the traditional religion of Japan's very syncretic. You know, they incorporate gods from other pantheons. They're not strict like other religions. So I thought, okay, if we have Japanese people colonizing the New World, how might they incorporate the native peoples into their religion? And also, how might colonizing the New World change the tales that the Japanese would bring with them? Because what I did in large part was I took as the base the this legend from Japanese mythology where there is a giant catfish under Japan, and every time it wiggles, an earthquake happens. But there's this water god who holds the catfish in place with a giant stone, but occasionally his grip will slip and the catfish will start wiggling, and that creates earthquakes. An interesting fact, even on Japanese television, when they have like earthquake alerts, they'll often include a cute little cartoon catfish in reference to that legend. Oh, you know, it was all about, my story was all about the mixing and changing of legends as they are brought to new lands.
Charlton, we've got you to come as well. You're still to come.
Yeah.
Tell us about yours.
My story is called Bedraeger William. To sum it all up, it is English Victorian folk hero Spinkill Jack in an alternative Dutch New Netherlands in an alternative American Revolution.
Okay, a lot of alternatives there.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, that's maybe our genre.
Yeah, that is very true. I think you might remember all the Kilroy Was Here, the little cartoons from the Second World War.
Yeah.
And it was kind of like that image, but like played kind of like sinisterly and also deliberately. The idea was like there were these partisan or regular attacks across the revolution, and they'd all be attributed to Bedraeger William. This kind of like smiling, anarchistic, Dutch-American folk hero, sort of like if the Joker was in the American Revolution, hence Smiling William, Smiling Bedraeger William, Smiling Will.
Yeah.
And it was also inspired by my long study and kind of like fascination of the Afrikaner people of South Africa, and like trying to imagine that, but in like an American context, and how that would develop in the American Revolution.
Josiah, of course, tell us about what you did.
My story is Let That Cold Steel Ring. I grew up in North Carolina in the South. I love Southern folk tales and folk legends, and I just loved John Henry as a kid. But being a Yankee and the son of Yankees, I don't have the same sympathies on the Civil War as most of my neighbors did growing up. So I thought it would be interesting to see, especially, so while I was at William & Mary, one of our professors there went through a long period of research and connecting the dots, figured out who the actual John Henry was. And he was a Union soldier that had wound up stranded in Virginia post-war and had got arrested probably on trumped up charges by a proto Jim Crow Virginia government. And that eventually most of these guys in this prison were sent to work on the railroads. They were farmed out to private companies as cheaper labor to work on the railroad tunnels that were being drilled through the Appalachian Mountains. So I thought it'd be interesting, what happened to John Henry as a Union soldier in a Union loses timeline? What does that look like? And then also, what does that look like in terms of the mythos of an America that's in conflict between North and South? So John Henry working on this railroad as a figure, not just of African-American manhood and strength, which he certainly was in our timeline, but as a figure for the oppressed people in the South, as an anti-slavery hero. Those were the kind of things I was playing with as I wrote the story. And I wanted to also take a stab at writing it in the style of those old Southern folktales.
Alex, coming to you now, what are the other stories from those who could not be here today?
Okay, so we have multiple takes on Texas and the part of the country that Mexico ruled. Yeah. One by Jason Sharp and one by Al Carroll. Brent Harris gave us a sort of a science fiction on history that combines the myth of George Washington with Frankenstein's monster, which is
actually too.
Which is not what I expected from to get, but was very good. So kudos to Brent. And I think the last one that I haven't mentioned is Ferguson Cayetano, another William & Mary graduate, like me and Josiah, who wrote a story of the Philippine-American War, about a myth from a world where the Philippines fight off the Americans, which I will admit is kind of stretching the theme of the anthology, but being someone who's half Filipino, I couldn't say no.
You can't say no, and you're the boss.
Yes.
Pretty much.
And it's a very good story. It is quite scary at times, and unfortunately Ferguson's name was left off of the Amazon page just because of the 10 author limit, and so I'm just gonna plug his name, his site, Ferguson Cayetano. So that sounds interesting to anyone, go look him up. He got screwed by Amazon, so I'm trying to make it up to him. Ferdison Cayetano. Ferguson Cayetano.
Ferguson Cayetano. Excellent, excellent. And how do people get hold of a Kindle copy, a proper paper copy if they want as well? Where can people get hold of it?
It's only an ebook for the moment. Sea Lion Press released it on Amazon and I believe the other sites that it does business on in December 2021. And so the name is Alo Americana, Myths and Legends from Alternate Americas, edited by yours truly, Alexander Wallace, the man with the name of the Scottish King. So if you want it, that's how you get it.
You'll be able to find out a lot more on the Sea Lion Press website generally as well. There's a lot there, particularly published sort of before Christmas time. And I think Gary from Sea Lion Press has done an interview with a couple of you guys as well, hasn't he?
I know Gary has interviewed me. I don't think he's done anyone else in this anthology as of yet, although maybe that would change.
It's going to happen. It's going to happen at some point. Okay, we're in any other business territory now. Has anyone got anything else that they want to say about the project, about the anthology, before we head off?
Buy it. It's good. We're excellent. Good writers. We know what we're doing.
Yes. Buy it so we get money from Sea Lion Press.
Excellent
yes,
stuff.
Please. Well, you give yourself some beer and chicken.
I want to especially plug Sam's story. I also love Indian folktales and coyote legends, specifically coyote's legends as a story. In the modern world, we don't think of how important folktales and folk stories are to different religions. And so having an alternate world where, the religion and the culture has been shaped by this interaction, I think really got to the heart of a lot of what was going on in this anthology and the goals of what we were trying to do in it.
Thank you. That's very nice to hear.
I love a bit of camaraderie to end the show off with. I don't know about you. Alas, that is almost time up for us on this particular episode. My thanks to Alex Wallace and friends for the feedback hub, and of course to Ewan Hodson earlier on for providing his knowledge of the Labour Party in the UK in the 1980s. The Alternate History Show returns next month at the end of April, and we're going slightly further afield on the next episode, away from my homeland, away from the world, and into space as we discuss alternate space travel history. I'll be joined by sci-fi author Bruno Lombardi to talk about that. I cannot wait. I'll be coming up in the next episodes at the end of next month. Don't forget, I'd Like Your Correspondence. Both me and Alex are available on the Sea Lion Press forum, on alternatehistory.com and other websites, and are waiting for you to have your say on the show. Meantime, have a very good month and enjoy your alternate history.